You're on Nightlife. Now that I'm back in the chair, we're resuming our Resting Places series where we take you to visit some of the world's most interesting cemeteries. Now, tonight, we're off to Romania. We're going to visit a very special cemetery that's known for its colour and whimsy. The Mary Cemetery is in a small village in the Maramureș region, which is in the north of Romania. It's known for its brightly painted carved wooden crosses, which contain an epitaph, sometimes quite funny, about the person buried below. Here, the celebration of life takes precedence over the sadness of death. Now, Peter Chiafas is a New York-based photographer. He spent a lot of time taking photos in Romania, including a series on the Mary Cemetery. He's here to tell you more about it tonight. Hey, Peter, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, Suzanne. I'm very happy to be with you guys.
So what led you, firstly, to Romania as a photographer and then specifically to the Mary Cemetery?
Oh, well, I'll try to make the lead up to the cemetery as short as I can, but I'm a photographer who has spent a lot of time both in the United States and abroad photographing things that are somewhat marginalized by popular culture. And in particular, when it came to Romania, it was on the heels of having spent a couple of years photographing in Cuba, which as an American is a complicated thing to do at any time, but especially in the late part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, there were all sorts of, as there still are, restrictions and punitive legislation about Americans traveling there. Long story short, I went there to photograph, had a great time, it was fascinating, it fit with a lot of the other work I was doing. But when I tried to go back again, I couldn't. I was forbidden to, and I had already sort of outed myself as somebody who was doing it officially, so I had gotten a license from the U.S. government. One thing led to another, and in the meantime, I had developed a quite close relationship to a couple dear friends of mine who were Romanian and who were living in Montreal and New York, respectively, and I have this interest in how communism in particular can or repression can preserve culture. And so here was Cuba, an island culture, still under the communist regime, where the kind of preservation of tradition was alive and well on the streets in a very different form than Eastern Europe. And then there was Romania, which had very recently fallen. Ceausescu had fallen and had become a sort of a democratic culture. So it fit quite nicely to go there and photograph. And I spent 2003, 2004, 2005, and a little bit of 2006 photographing all over the country. I mean, most of the major cities, the countryside. And at one point in 2003, my friend Cezar, who was the consummate tour guide and historian of Romanian culture, said, we must go to Maramureș. It's right near the border with Ukraine. And there's a town called Sapunta in which there is a famous cemetery. It was initially called the Gay Cemetery, but it got a whole different kind of tourism than it had intended. So they retranslated it to be the Mary Cemetery. And indeed, when we went there and I photographed it, at first with black and white film, I thought this is something very special here. So I returned again to photograph it in color.
Yeah. So Peter, take us to the moment when you arrived for the first time. Did you know what to expect or was it a surprise to you?
Oh, it was completely a surprise. I mean, you know, there's two parts to this story, Suzanne. So the first part is the initial surprise where I'm traveling Romania and I'm photographing its culture and I have my usual 35 millimeter camera with my black and white Kodak Tri-X film. And I walk into the cemetery and it's sort of rainy and a little bit dreary. And these pictures, because I don't speak or read Romanian, are just the most profound manifestations of a clear relationship and a somewhat despondent and spiteful relationship with mortality that I, you know, immediately said to my friend, all right, what are these? Because of course, if anybody's seen them, there's a picture on the grave. Sometimes it's a portrait. Sometimes it depicts the scene of a person's death. And then beneath that, there are rhyming couplets carved into the wood that are mostly told from the first person. It's a narrative first person description of the death and of the person's life, and often an indictment of those people who have survived them. So the combination of seeing this for the first time and hearing my friend read to me out loud while I was looking at them and photographing them, these, like I said, first person narratives was really striking. And I should just say that wherever I travel, I think cemeteries, I can't necessarily go there first, but I go there always. So whatever new country or town or place that I go to, I try to always go to the cemetery because I think it says something collectively and anecdotally about that particular culture that nothing else can.
Having seen, of course, Peter, all of these crosses that have this beautiful blue on them, you couldn't have possibly done it justice in black and white, right? Which is why you must have decided you had to come back.
Precisely. In fact, there is no other project in the 40 plus years that I have worked with photography that has been in color. But I really wanted the pictures that I made for what I had in mind right away would be a book to be in color, because the color is an essential part of it. It's essential in terms of how they appear in the style of the various artists who were involved in carving these things, beginning with Jan Stan Patrasch, or Stan Jan Patrasch, as he's sometimes called, and his mentees, his proteges, whom he trained and who are still to this day carving, as far as I know, those same crosses. It felt like I needed to come back, and I did a year later, and photograph everything in color and hire, collaborate with a proper translator and just do justice to what I think is, at least, I mean, I hope somebody proves me wrong and sends me an email and finds me and says, oh, you have to go to this cemetery in Pakistan, or you have to go to the cemetery in Cusco or wherever it is. But I've never seen anything like this in the world. And it needed to be in color to pay it proper homage.
Now, Peter, can you remember, or do you have access to any of those couplets? I'd love to hear some descriptions of the kinds of things that are written on these graves.
Oh my God, I do. I mean, so I worked with a really wonderful and brilliant translator who will be famous to Romanians. His name is Adrian Sahlean, and he's particularly famous because he translated Mihai Eminescu, who is to this day considered the great Romanian national poet, the great Romanian poet, who was famous for a quite beautiful and moving long poem called The Evening Star. And so one of the things that we tried to do is make sure that we preserve some of the primitive colloquialisms that were associated with the actual Romanian text on the gravestones. So, you know, it would be easy to polish things up, but we wanted to, like I said, to preserve the kind of the language of the people. And these are people who lived in the Carpathian Mountains, above the Carpathian Mountains, with isolated from the big cities like Bucharest, et cetera. And they spoke and they were agrarian. They plowed for a living. They were in a small community. There's 3,000 or 4,000 people in this town. And so these indicting, amazing, somewhat poetic, rhyming couplet verses that are autobiographical were really profound to see and to learn, because, of course, I'm responding to the visual aspect of it first. But I know your listeners won't have access to the pictures that go along with them, but maybe I'll read a couple as you ask, Suzanne. So one of them, which is one of the frontispiece pictures that I have in my book, is really quite beautiful rendering, if you can imagine it, of a bas-relief carving of a man standing in traditional northern Marmaresh garb, holding a scythe that he's sharpening, and the text beneath him carved into the wood says, "For as long as I lived, I loved everything I did. When the weather was fine, in the summer I worked with my children and wife to make hay with the scythe. When clouds or rain came, I was never lazy. World, I leave you behind so others can live in you." And he lived from 1946 to 1996. And then there's one more that is, I mean, there's many. Of course, the book has, I didn't count, but there's probably 50 or so of them. But there's another one of a that depicts is much more colorful, and this is clearly a cross that has been carved by one of Jan Stan Patrasch's proteges, because it's much more modern in its depiction and stylistically different, and still sort of folk art in its approach, and some people would call it primitive. Also, much more brightly colored. Some of the older crosses have not been repainted, and so they show their age, which in some cases is at this point, almost 100 years old. But this one depicts a young man in jeans and a t-shirt with rollerblades on train tracks or subway tracks with a metro in the background. And the text reads, "I liked to do everything, but chose the road to death, the road to the West. May it burn in fire. In the Paris underground, I played with sick passion, with rollerblades, and death cut short my life. dear sister and parents and beloved grandparents, you will be sad and grieve for me forever, for I left this world very young at age 16.
Wow.
So that shows a little bit also, of course, it betrays or gives us insight into the criticism that this agrarian, non-cosmopolitan culture had for modernism and for cities and for places.
And for the fascination with the West too, I think. Yeah.
And for the fascination with the West, absolutely. Yeah. So the combination of the pictures and the text is really magical to me. And the book was really meant to do homage to the people who put that together.
Peter Kayafas is my guest. He's a New York-based photographer. He produced this book about the Merry Cemetery, you know, photos and text. Just listening to that one that you just described there, Peter, I mean, I presume that, you know, the young man who died, he didn't write that. Who actually wrote that? Does the family get any say, or is it all down to the people who are actually making the crosses?
It's a combination of a lot of different things, and I would imagine that the emphasis or the resources or the primary sources for how that gets written change from year to year and individual to individual. I'll sort of direct your listeners to the essay by Sanda Golopensia, who is the Romanian scholar and longtime professor at Brown, who wrote an afterword about the process and the history, and in particular the unusual and fascinating practices of this area, both religious and sort of folkloric and superstitious. There were a few different sources. One is that people could actually pay a certain amount of money to have important life events recorded in what we would, I think, at least in the United States, have as equivalent as a town hall. So if somebody got married, if somebody died, if somebody had their first child, if somebody had something good or bad happen in their life, you might spend a very small amount of money to have that recorded. So there were these public records for people who could afford to have them. And then there were the funerary tradition, which is that they would have these long funerals for people who died, during which the women in particular would be around the body and would sort of, in some cases, speak in tongues, but also reminisce about the person's life. And then there is the artist himself, Jan Stan Patras, who would avail himself of this collective knowledge that was on deposit, but also situate himself in the kitchens, or which is often where these sort of memorial services took place, and listen to the wailing and the anecdotes that came from the family, especially if he'd been paid to do so. And then he would come up with this first-person narrative, which obviously in some cases must have been influenced directly or more directly, depending on how much money there was to be paid for it, by the family. But what's remarkable about them, of course, is no, they're not written by the deceased, except in the remarkable case of Patrasch himself, which is another anecdote. They were mostly written by the artist and by the families and by the people who were left. And so there's a kind of self-flagellation, I think. It's existentially very interesting for the people who have survived their beloved, which, you know, in some cases they're children, in some cases they're old people, but in every case there's this kind of thumbing of the nose at death.
So tell us a bit more about Jan Stan Patrasch and how this all started for him and how it basically came to be what is done at the Merry Cemetery.
My understanding, which comes from some research and from some conversation with people and from Sanda Golopensia's essay, is like many histories, I'm sure there are disputable aspects to it, but there are some remarkable, I think, consensus. One is that he was trained in a classical wood carving tradition in the western part of Romania, what we now know of as Transylvania, which has been an area that's been disputed by the possession of which has been disputed by both Hungary and Romania, and maybe even to this day, but certainly when I was there, is still a hot topic. Many of your listeners might have heard of the great sculptor and artist Brancusi, or in Romanian speak, Brâncuș. It's believed that Patras was trained in a similar method of carving Carpathian hardwoods. And he was hired at first to carve these quite ornate, beautiful crosses and gates that are in front of the houses and define the properties of many of the people in the modern Maresh district. And at the same time, he also started carving crosses, but just crosses that would function as the head, or what we might call the headstone or the gravestone for where people were buried. And gradually he got more interested in making these things more elaborate. He started incorporating color, in particular the shades of blue that are typical of the monasteries that are in the northern nearby northern Moldavian area of Romania. And then I don't quite know when he had the whimsy to, or the prescience to begin to make portraits, but he presumably it came from the tradition that existed from the 1920s on in Italy and various other places of putting photographic portraits of people on gravestones. So actually in some of the cases in Sapunzu, you'll find both a photographic portrait and Patrasche's actual carved bas-relief wooden portrait. And then at some point, I think it must be supply, right? It must be about responding to your audience and your clientele. He started carving images that went beyond just a portrait, just like a sort of headshot portrait, head and shoulders portrait, to actually depict the scene of a person's death. And some of them became quite elaborate. And I would say since Patrasche's passing, his in 1977, his protégés, his descendants, mentees, have continued to elaborate to the degree that you can find a picture carved on the stone, on the wood, depicting, you know, a little girl in a polka dot dress bouncing off the hood of a car with a text that says something about the damned taxi that took her life when she was young at the age of 16 or something like that. So I think they just became more and more elaborate, and they served the community. That was what Patrasche has always said in public, and what he said in his own epitaph, that he really just, he did what the people wanted him to do.
And so in the cemetery then, Peter, do you find there are gravestones that aren't carved like this, or is it the vast majority that are? Because you kind of want, yeah, I suppose from an out, I've never been there, but you want to imagine that you rock up and they are all like this, but how many are?
Well, so it's obvious if one pays attention to the different styles and the different conditions. So imagine, without being too skilled in the forensics of degradation of wood and paint, et cetera, in the very harsh environment of northern Romania, it's still fairly clear to anybody who really looks that these things have been around for a long time. I mean, the earliest in the cemetery, and I'm assuming that some of them are still standing, it's been a while since I've been there, are from the 1930s. So they're nearly 100 years old. Presumably many of those that are that old have gone away, have fallen down, have either been replaced or not replaced. A big part of their longevity is dependent on the family continuing to pay for their upkeep, which means repainting them and rehabilitating them. And like anybody who's been to any cemetery that's been around for 100 or more years, you know, you can see graves that are broken, graves that are fallen, graves that are disintegrated, newer graves, graves that have been rehabilitated. And I think that's the same as the case with the Mary Cemetery of Sapunzu. So you have many hands involved. I mean, by my estimate, at least three or four different artisans have been making, carving these things based on the style. And then you have the whole era of, or the whole aspect of time from mid-1930s until the present. So they're all similar. And when you walk in, it's kind of like this, it's an extraordinary experience to walk in through a gate and see a long, narrow, imagine it like a football pitch, but maybe 25 or 50% larger. So it's long and it's rectangular. And there are these rows of these crosses that have very like distinct color. And as you get closer, each one of them tells a story. Each one of them is specific to a person. And they themselves represent the passage of time and also a sort of legacy of artisanship from the 1930s of Patrasche through the present day, while, as I understand it, they're still being carved.
Yeah, wow. And Peter, just you did mention that Jan Stan Patrasche actually wrote his own poem for his cross. Tell us about that poem.
Well, I can read a part of it to you. What's remarkable or what's amusing, and this is Sandra de Golopensia talks about this in her essay, apparently he took, as one might imagine, since this was his business, he took it very serious. I guess it would be like somebody writing their own eulogy, right, or their own obituary. And so he apparently had many drafts going, and all of them were much, much too long to fit on the actual cross itself. But there is, so there, he has a front and back of his cross. I wish you could see it. I have it in my book. It's the first picture in the book of an individual grave. And the front has a portrait of him that was presumably carved. It's not his style, so I'm assuming it was carved by one of his mentees, his protégés. And the front is sort of less interesting than the back, so I'll read the back. The back actually depicts him carving one of the crosses. So it's this, you can imagine it's sort of a rudimentary, almost like cartoon-like 14 or 18 by 18 inch, very colorful picture of a man sitting on a cross, a wooden cross that is recognizable as those that are in the cemetery. And he's got a hammer and a chisel and he's carving. And next to him is a man in traditional Marmaresh garb playing the violin, and presumably in some sort of a mourning or acknowledgement of his passing. And so this is the text. It's short like the other ones. It says, "Since I was 14, I had to earn money from hard work in the woods with the saw and the hatchet. Father went to war and never came back. Three small children he left behind in a world of heavy sorrow. I wish I lived more to see my plans come true. From 62 countries, people visited me till yesterday. Many state leaders visited me. From now on, when they come, they'll find me here no more. I wish them well, all who came to visit me, for I left my life at age 69. That's Jan Sten Patrasch, the artist of the Mary Cemetery of Sapunsa.
Wow. Just an extract, though, because of its extraordinary length. You have really inspired me to want to go and visit this cemetery. Does it get a lot of tourists?
You know, I don't really know because, well, when I was there, there were very few. I've been there three times. The first time I was there, there was almost nobody else there, which was amazing. The second time that I was there, it was during Easter, and it was very crowded, but it was crowded with people who used the cemetery as the place to celebrate the rebirth of Christ. And the Easter ceremony in the Eastern Orthodox Church, i.e. Greece and Romania and a few other places, is the most sacred holiday. So for a lot of people in the West, it's Christmas, but Easter is a very important holiday. There's fasting involved, and then there are these incredible ceremonies involved. So I happened to be there during Easter, and the cemetery was utterly packed. But it was packed with people in traditional Marmaresh garb, and they were in the midst of the highest worship. And so it was quite beautiful to behold. So there weren't tourists, but there were crowds. And then the last time I was there, there were more tourists because, well, there are things like this radio show, which get people who have curiosity and ambition to actually go see things that are profoundly beautiful. And so I'd like to think that there were people there who appreciated the sort of irony and the beauty and the artisanship and the history of the place rather than just making a selfie. And I don't know what it's quite like now, but I would say it's worth the trip. And it's worth paying attention to and being respectful of.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us on Nightlife to take us to the Mary Cemetery in Romania tonight.
Suzanne, thank you for your time, and thanks to all your listeners for bearing with me and for thinking about the Mary Cemetery. It's an extraordinary place.
It's Peter Kiafas. He's a New York-based photographer who produced a book, The Mary Cemetery, which is full of photographs of what looks like, and do yourselves a favour, as Molly Meldrum would have said, look it up online. It really is the most extraordinary pictures. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.